Hello, Space Watchers, and welcome back to a new episode of Space Cafe Radio. I'm Emma, contributing editor of Space Watch Global. And today we are going to round up the 4 weeks of the Amadi 20 mission. This is the fifth and final episode of our coverage of the mission, which started on the 4th of October and ended just 10 days ago, on the 31st of October. Amadi 20, for those of you that don't know it, is a Mars analog simulation based in the Negev Desert in Israel. And the mission is managed by the Austrian Space Forum and hosted by the Israeli Space Agency. If you have not listened to the previous ones, do not start from this one. You can find the entire series on spacewatch.global. Our guest today is Dr. Robert Wild, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Innsbruck in Austria. Robert is an experimental physicist studying astrochemistry in the lab by day, but guess what? He is an analog astronaut by night. Robert, welcome back to Earth and welcome to Space Cafe Radio. Thank you for joining us today. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm getting, you know, used to being here again, used to being in my normal job, my normal work.
So you spent 3 weeks in the middle of the Israeli desert pretending to be on Mars. How did it go?
I would say overall it went well. I mean, it depends on what you specify as the goals, right? If you say we wanted to have a mission where everything went perfectly well as if it was on Mars, then it didn't go so well. However, the point of the mission was to learn things and you learn from mistakes, right? And so there were mistakes made, there were experiments that didn't work, and I think everyone learned a lot from this, but this was part of the point.
So what's the biggest thing you learn, the biggest mistake or the major success, depending from the point of view?
Well, it's not directly a question for me, because during this mission, of course, we had many experiments put together by research institutions and universities from everywhere, over 20 experiments, and for most of these, the data goes to the PIs, and for many of them, I don't really know how well it ended up working or not. They have to go through the data first. But, you know, there were definitely a few hardware issues, like a drone had to be fixed. We had some tools in the habitat as well. In isolation means we had to try to do most of the fixing and most of the working on things ourselves.
Of course.
And we were able to do that as well. We got all the drones to fly that wanted to fly. We also had this rover that we were steering from inside the habitat in order to explore the outside, the surrounding area and the outside of the habitat. And with that, there were some bandwidth issues that we had to, you know, not everything worked as well as it could. But again, this is a part of the learning process.
Of the game, of course. Let's speak about your personal experience. I know that often astronauts, they do have peculiar physical or emotional effects, like thinking about astronauts usually often lose sleep on the ISS. Did you experience any peculiar effects during these 3 weeks of isolation?
I wouldn't say peculiar effects. I mean, we had 4 weeks in the desert and 3 weeks of isolation. During this time, we had quite a tight schedule and lots of things to do, right? It seems like a lot, but these 4 weeks go very quickly. And when you have a lot of experiments to do, you have very little time. And so we actually lost just because we had so much to do. It wasn't very peculiar. We just, you know, stayed up late and had to get up early. So it's very standard loss of sleep. Beyond that, I actually didn't feel any different. But interestingly, one of the effects seems to be that I lost weight. We had a lot of food and we always prepared too much. And so I always felt like I ate way too much. I was trying to, you know, finish the plate, not let anything go to waste. And so I was stuffing myself at every meal. And I was assuming, and all of us were assuming, that we were gaining weight. But when I came home, people told me that I lost weight. That was very unexpected.
And what's the typical analog astronaut diet on Mars?
So we had a vegan diet. And the whole meal plan was put together by a school in Upper Austria, a school of dietology. The main points were that needed to be balanced. It needed to have all the vitamins and minerals and nutrition that we needed, but it also needed to be pretty much non-perishable. We had some fresh fruit and things at the beginning, but towards the end of the 4 weeks that ran out, most of it was sort of canned foods, some frozen foods, sort of pre-prepared aspects. And the other aspect of it was that we can't spend so much time preparing meals because we have more important things to do. We have experiments to run. This meal plan was put together in a sense to make it extremely easy or extremely quick to put together, which basically means that, you know, if you imagine putting something together very quickly from canned foods, it's usually not the highest quality. Sometimes it was quite good. Mm-hmm. Other times we have had a laugh about, you know, how not great it was. But it was, in the end, it was, you know, it wasn't bad.
Of course. Yeah. Well, 3 weeks is fine. Suppose when it becomes 6 months, then when it becomes more relevant. Can you tell us something about this preparation?
There was the physical training. So we had to actually build muscle, build back muscles and whatnot in order to be prepared for the physical effort of wearing these spacesuit simulators, which are quite heavy. So that was months ahead already. We got a training schedule where 3 to 4 days a week we were given the exercises. So that was on a very personal level. However, there are also all these experiments that we were constantly doing, and we can't just go to the habitat and be handed an experiment and start doing this. We have to know about this ahead of time. And so during the 2 years before the mission, we, every couple months or so, we had a training weekend where we all got together as best as we could somewhere online with the principal investigators, the people who made this experiment, where they trained us on the machinery or on the process of how to do these. The 2 years leading up to this, we did a lot of reading up. We did a lot of, you know, on these weekends, handling the actual experiments, seeing how we can actually put it together so that we kind of know what we're doing during these 4 weeks. It was overall a long time of training.
It was too long because there's been COVID in the middle and that slowed down the process, or it would have been 2 years, not too long. It would have been 2 years anyway, with or without.
No, so it actually, you know, the mission was called Amadei 20 and still is called Amadei 20 because the original goal was for it to have been October of last year. And because of COVID, we had to postpone it for 1 year. And so we got a little bit more training out of it, which was actually quite beneficial to all of us. But it was to only prepare essentially for a year or a little over 1 year.
Okay, so more or less the same. So something that I've been wondering for a while now is how do you become an analog astronaut? Which are the selection parameters that decide that the person is the right fit for such a mission?
As far as I can tell, you know, because I wasn't the person selecting myself. However, when we applied for this position, and as far as I know, there were over 100 applications from all over Europe to be the new analog astronaut class of 2019. And then out of those, they picked 30 people, invited them to Innsbruck, and we had a whole range of tests. There were some written tests just about basic knowledge about technical background or technical knowledge. There were definitely physical tests, you know, fitness tests. There were mental tests. There was activities of working in groups to see how well we do with teamwork, communication tests. There isn't one exact perfect person, right, who is an analog astronaut or an astronaut, but it's a combination of a lot of traits that work well together for these sorts of missions.
Yeah, the people that we spoke with before you, they all say that you guys had to get along to form the group. They were very careful in being sure that all of you liked each other.
Yes, I think to me that was the most important factor. Almost surprising to me. I mean, I don't have a psychology background. You know, I'm a physicist, but we were put together. They give us psychological questionnaires and do some psychological interviews, and then they put us together. And I was always wondering, you know, how well does that really work? You know, think of it as a matchmaking, right? If your friend puts together, you say, oh,
yeah,
you two
exactly.
will get along great together. It's not usually that good of an idea. But in this case, I was really surprised how well it worked. After the selection process, I felt like, wow, these people were chosen to be my friends, essentially, because all of them are great people. I really get along with them very well. And when we went on this mission, we're under pressure, time stress, you know, things go wrong. We just always worked it out. And it was amongst each other, there was always a good mood. I'm quite impressed at how well the psychological team did this.
My suggestion to the psychological team as a parameter of selection was snoring. I say, you know, you have to be careful because if one of them snore, that's not going to end up well. I was very worried about that.
Yes, however, there are simple pragmatic solutions like earplugs that can also solve this issue.
Earplugs.
However, I can say that it was not even an issue for us. Maybe it was pre-selected, I don't know, but it turned out not to be a problem.
Somebody confirmed that actually is a parameter that is kept into consideration.
Oh, okay.
So I was wondering, from your experience, what do you think it would be the thing that an astronaut would miss the most during a proper Mars mission, during a year-long mission on the Red Planet?
That's a good question. I haven't directly considered that before. From my short experience, this was only 4 weeks. In that sense, almost no time spent in isolation for me. But even after that time, the thing I've missed most was just being able to go outside for a walk. It's very different, you know, with a spacesuit and having this enclosure around you and having to do work. But the thing I looked forward to when I came back home was just to go into town for half an hour and walk around. I imagine on a very long mission to just feel the air in your face and just have this freedom of, well, maybe it's a combination, not just being outside, but also you don't have to fulfill anything specific. You have the freedom to just leave, go outside, have nothing scheduled. That was the part that I looked forward to most. And I can imagine that for a real mission, that would also be a similar effect. Possible problems that one would think of, like the monotony of the landscape, that didn't really affect me so much. This desert was absolutely beautiful. I didn't feel like I missed it. It keeps being referred to a three-week isolation, but interestingly, for me, I didn't feel isolated at all because I was actually interacting with the crew, with these other five people constantly, and I felt, you know, more connected than I usually do at home when I'm not always hanging out around other people. So I felt socially quite unisolated. The food, sure, there was better food out there, but that didn't really affect me. But just being able to go outside on your free time and have a nice walk, that was the biggest thing for me, I think.
So what's the first thing you did when you came back?
Well, I was picked up at the airport by some family and my wife. It was very nice to have conversations with new and different people again, and people who mean a lot to me. And then, of course, we came and had some very nice tea and dessert. Also something to have, you know, I was just saying how the food is not so important, but then when I had good food again, it was very nice.
You remembered.
It was one of the things. Exactly, I remembered. They were several things that you don't think about, you know, nice long hot showers rather than short ones, things like that. But the main thing really was the part I was looking for was just to take an aimless walk around town. Yeah.
Did you have time shower? So did you have strict time, which you had, I suppose, so you can
No,
just...
there were not strict times. We had limited water. So there were just kind of general ideas. We should shower something like once every 3 days. Or if we've just done an EVA, because then we get extremely sweaty. And then we should keep shower times short. Hmm. There was nothing strict, but it was understood that we should be conserving water.
It makes perfect sense considering the setup. So thank you very much, Robert, for telling us your side of the story and your experience as an analog astronaut. Obviously, I wish you good luck with any future mission. Are you going to be in another mission again?
Well, I definitely hope so. We have the Austrian Space Force has a core of 13 analog astronauts currently that are trained and ready to go at any moment with extra preparation. And so out of these 13 is always what the crew will be chosen for whatever next mission comes up. And it's not guaranteed that I'm in the next mission, but it's a definite possibility and I would definitely love to be part of it again.
Well, then I hope to be able to talk to you again. And this is the final episode of our podcast mini-series about living on Mars, but we will be back with more podcasts and more stories and more thoughts about the space industry. So please stay with this. This is all from Emma and from Space Cafe Radio. Till next time. Bye.